Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Mark Danner, who is in Ramallah in the Palestinian territory, and discuss the upcoming declaration of Palestinian statehood at the United Nations that the Saudis are warning the US not to veto. We will also talk with Mark Danner's about Mark Danner's latest essay in the New York Review of Books, After September the 11th, Our State of Exception. Then, following the President's recent address to Congress to urge the creation of more jobs, we'll talk with Douglas Rushkoff about whether jobs are obsolete in the digital age, where technology is increasing efficiency that results in more people being laid off while increasing corporate profits. Douglas Rushkoff teaches media studies at NYU and is the author of Program or Be Programmed, 10 Commands for a Digital Age, and Life, Inc., How Corporations Conquered the World and How We Can Take It Back. Joining us now is Mark Danner, who is a writer, journalist, and professor. Mark Danner was a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker. He's a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books and teaches at the University of California, Berkeley, and Bard College. His books include Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War, The Secret Way of War, The Downing Street Memo, and The Iraq War's Buried History, and Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. He has an article, After September the 11th, Our State of Exception, now at the New York Review of Books. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Danner.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be here.
And you are, of course, in Ramallah, on the West Bank, about to be declared a Palestinian state. We've got so much to talk about. Can I begin with that? In as much as in Monday's New York Times, there is an article by the former head of Saudi intelligence, Prince Turki, basically laying down a pretty strong marker to the United States and saying, you know, the U.S.'s credibility is pretty thin in the Arab world. And as far as the Saudis are concerned, if they don't go along with Palestinian statehood, the Saudi relationship with the United States will change forever. And it's a pretty stark warning. Is it likely to be listened to, do you think?
Well, I think if you consider being listened to an actual change in policy in Washington, to do what Prince Turki is urging, which is that the United States refrain from vetoing the resolution for Palestinian statehood, I think it's very unlikely to be observed in Washington. I do think it's an extremely serious shot across the bow of U.S. policy. Prince Turki is a very highly respected member of the Saudi royal family. He was for many years the head of Saudi intelligence. He knows where all the bodies are buried, and then finished his career with holding the ambassadorship in Washington. So he's extremely well connected. And this is a rather fierce piece, essentially saying that U.S. Middle East policy with respect to the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations has been fruitless, stagnant, and without issue, and that the U.S. is about to make a terrible error by setting it back still further by vetoing this resolution for statehood, which will cost it very materially among regimes in the Arab world, including the Saudis. It's rather strikingly angry and aggressive piece. I must say I was rather startled by the tone, and also by the fact that there's a rationale that's quite compelling in it, which is that the Assad regime in Damascus, according to the prince, is about to collapse. The Saudis issued an extremely strong statement condemning Bashar al-Assad for killing civilians. And the prince at this point basically says, look, you Americans are in a great position to weaken your arch rival in the region, the Iranians, by unseating the Assad regime. And just as you're about to do that, you're going to make this huge diplomatic mistake, which is going to cost you a great deal of sympathy on the part of Arab countries, particularly the ones that newly feel the necessity to listen to their populations, like Egypt, in the wake of the Arab Spring. So he makes a pretty compelling argument that this will be a serious diplomatic mistake and perhaps a cataclysmic one. What's so sad is that, you know, on reading it, you think, well, there's absolutely no chance that the Obama administration will not veto this resolution. So I guess it indicates how frozen and stagnant and sclerotic American policy on this issue has been under the Obama administration.
But Mark Denner, I think the implication surely from Prince Turkey is that if the U.S. vetoes this, as it will because of, you know, the power of the Israel lobby in the Congress and on the White House, they have actually more influence over the Democrats than they do over the Republicans. And that seems to be the assumption that's why the president simply has no room to maneuver, which in itself is a discussion, a topic for a long discussion. Seems odd that the United States shouldn't have its own independent foreign policy in this regard. However, what I think he's implying here, Prince Turkey, is that this veto of Palestinian statehood from the Americans may actually change the subject in Syria, which is what the Assad dictatorship is trying to do. They've already played the Palestinian card. They'd love to have this card to play again to distract the world from their brutality towards their own people. And the Iranians are in there supplying, not only are they propping this government up with money, they're also sending in their IRGC thugs and besieged militias and Al-Quds people to crack heads and murder Syrians. So,
yeah. Yes, you're right. It is a gift. It is a gift to the Bashar al-Assad regime. There's no question about that. And of course, he hasn't been above using the Israel issue repeatedly as a distraction. Letting his own Palestinian population approach the Israeli border a few months back, which eventuated in a shooting incident at the border, and so on. So we've seen this before, and I think it's true that this will be a kind of diplomatic gift to him. I'm not sure that it's enough to save the regime or materially alter what's going on within the country. But Prince Turkey may quite be right that if you look at what's going on in Syria in a geostrategic sense and think of it as essentially depriving Iran of its key ally, then from his point of view, it's a pretty compelling argument that this represents a pretty gravely missed opportunity.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Denner, who is in Ramallah on the West Bank of Palestine. He also has an article in the current issue of the New York Review of Books, After September 11th, Our State of Exception. And let's just turn a little bit to that, unless, Mark, you have something to tell me about what's on the ground there to give me a sense of, I take it that the Palestinian people are right behind this. And interesting enough, just finishing up on the subject of the Saudis, it was, after all, the Saudis who proffered a peace proposal a number of years back that the Israelis rejected. Recently, the former head of Mossad, Maya Dagan, castigated the Netanyahu government and reminded them of the folly of turning that proposal down or not even taking it seriously, given the growing isolation of Israel in the region.
Yes. The 2005 proposal, or 2002, I'm sorry, proposal is referred to by Prince Turki Al-Faisal in his article. And, you know, it does, that seems a very long time ago. And you realize, we're still, when you see Israeli diplomats interviewed on television, as I just did earlier today, they're still referring to the Oslo framework. And, you know, we're talking about a peace deal of the early to mid-90s. And in fact, there is a feeling here generally of complete stagnation the Netanyahu government has been completely uninterested in making any progress. We just have a sort of regime solidifying in place based on the wall and a kind of unbearable situation on the ground in the West Bank. It's really shocking to come back here and just see the whole regime of checkpoints and areas A, B, C, and just the sheer difficulty of living here. And this has been, we want, It's an odd thing to come and look at things on the ground, and you realize that when we talk about the situation here, we kind of are pointed or looking up at this kind of cloud of rhetoric in which you hear two-state solution, Oslo, the Saudi plan, all these other things. And meanwhile, things on the ground have simply just gotten steadily worse. And as opposed to the rhetorical talk about the future, the present really is made not of rhetoric but of concrete. You know, it's settlements. It's the wall. It's these permanent facts on the ground that make life here pretty much unbearable. So I think, you know, I have a sense that we're reaching a point, it's not just my sense, where, you could be at the point of another explosion, which have happened periodically in the past, when things have stagnated in the way they have here for the last decade or so. And I'm sad to say that the Obama administration came in with very strongly stated ambitions to move the peace process forward. They suffered an early failure when they tried to force a settlement freeze on the Netanyahu government. The Netanyahu government basically said no. It's a complicated story, but that really is what happened. And they backed down. And that, in a sense, was kind of the end of it. So here we are. And, you know, it's one of those situations where Americans, you know, it's like there's a darkness about policy, and suddenly, boom, like lightning on a darkened landscape, you have an explosion, and it's as if, well, where did this come from? And it's very clear where it's come from, which is in some, not the least sense, lack of urgency on the part of American policy and lack of willingness to take a risk. So here we are again.
Well, Mark Denner, something paradoxical is happening there, surely, and that is in the entire region, you have the Arab Spring, and it is clearly the young Syrians are taking their lives in their hands to try and facing military equipment to bring about their own freedom, and the young Palestinians, I imagine, are no exception, as is the case in Tunisia and Egypt, and indeed in Saudi Arabia, where the royal family are basically trying to buy them off. So I sense a peculiar irony here that you have all these young Israelis protesting about the lack of future in terms of economic opportunity in their country, because it's essentially run by an economic oligarchy. And the same thing is happening on the Arab side. They're saying exactly the same thing. The older, corrupt oligarchs have stolen our future.
Yeah. Yes, you see that. You see that everywhere, of course. It's a little, to me, more complicated and inscrutable here on the West Bank, simply because, you know, I see among young people a kind of great excitement about what has gone on, particularly about what happened in Egypt. But it's unclear when exactly, and that's why I say perhaps it'll happen soon with the declaration of statehood, when it will and how it will manifest itself here in front of us. You're quite right that you have this movement going on at the same time. I'm laughing because it's kind of incredible, this sort of social movement that has to do with cost of living and difficulties of housing and so on in Israel, in which you've had hundreds of thousands of people out demonstrating, predominantly young people. And that movement, you know, ironically, strangely enough, is self-consciously pointed away from the problems of Middle East peace and West Bank and occupied territories and so on, even though, of course, intrinsic, you know, bound up very tightly in the housing problem in Israel has been the occupation of the West Bank and the fact that the government over the last 30-odd years has been putting most of its money into building settlements on the West Bank. I mean, that's been its housing program. And the social movement in Israel is kind of self-consciously looking in the other direction. And I think there's a feeling that if they get to this root of the problem, that will be divisive. You know, it will suddenly be a peace movement rather than a movement about cost of living and housing, which is just, you know, such an astonishing thing. So I'd like to, you know, agree with you. It's on the one hand, you've had this movement sweeping the region, and you expect, well, it's got to emerge here, explode here, and that may well be what happens. I think it's likely to. But there's also a strange temper here of frustration, stagnation, and to some degree disillusionment that makes it a little bit difficult to me, predict what will happen. It's one of the reasons I've been so interested to be here.
Let's take a brief station break now, and I'll be back in a minute talking with Mark Denner from Ramallah.
Now I've been crying lately, thinking about the world as it is. Why must we go on hating? Why can't we live in bliss? 'Cause I'm on the edge of darkness. There I holding out the light on the beach. Well, I should stop pointing fingers, reserve my judgment of all the public action figures, the cowboy presidents, so loud behind the bullhorn, so proud they can't admit when they've made a mistake. While poison spews from a speechwriter's pen, he knows he don't have to say it, so it don't bother him.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Again, I'm speaking with Mark Danner, who is in Ramallah in the Palestinian territory, and we're talking about Palestinian statehood that's all but inevitable soon. He also has an article in the current issue of the New York Review of Books, After September 11th, Our State of Exception. And I still want to get to the article, but it's so interesting to talk to you since you're there on the ground. Do you think, just to finish up on this, do you think that the trigger, though, that could turn the Palestinian youth in terms of the Arab Spring into massive street demonstrations that we've seen elsewhere could be the U.S. veto of Palestinian statehood? Could that be the trigger?
Well, I think it's possible. Although, remember, you know, everybody knows the U.S. is going to veto it. I guess my short answer would be, I don't know. There's a strange reality here where it's almost as if you have a choreographed series of events leading up to the actual vote for statehood, which we assume will be overwhelmingly positive, and the veto in the Security Council, which we also assume is predetermined. I mean, it's hard to believe there's going to be a different result, even though there's a lot of last-minute politicking. So all of that seems to be foreordained.
I was going to say, but doesn't that mean for the Palestinians, you have a vote, the whole world says you are now a state, and however long it takes to veto it, suddenly the whole thing is taken away from them, and the people who take it away from them are the Americans.
Yes. Well, no, you're quite right. That is going to be what happens. I'm just saying, to me it's somewhat difficult to predict what the popular, how extended, put it that way, the popular reaction will actually be. The Israelis, it is widely reported, are going to be cracking down quite severely on the West Bank. And remember, there's an apparatus here that is deeply enmeshed in life all over the West Bank in the form of a very heavily militarized system of checkpoints. And separate roads for Palestinians and Israelis. The Israelis have the capability very easily to shut down all movement on the West Bank, contain things, and so on. So there is, I guess what I'm trying to say is there's more than one player here. And the question is, how will the Israelis react? What will the Palestinians do? What will the Palestinian leadership in the form of the PA, how will they react? How much control will they try to assert over demonstrations? Will they want to contain it, which my expectation is they will. And then there is kind of unpredictable nature of how these things have happened. You know, the first intifada was very much outside of the institutional realm. I mean, the PA wasn't here, and this thing erupted as a kind of popular movement to the surprise of everybody. Will you have something like some equivalent of that happen this time around? There have been sort of popular peace movements, peaceful resistance, in various villages that have cropped up in reaction originally to the building of the wall. What part will they play? So I think there are a lot of kind of imponderables here. And again, it's one of the reasons I wanted to be here.
So, Mark Danner, of course, You've written one of the most important books about the post 9/11 issue of torture, Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and the War on Terror. And you've written this article in the current issue of the New York Review of Books, After September 11th, Our State of Exception. And I think probably people have seen quite enough of the 9/11 coverage, which has been understandably pretty intense. But it's had a kind of a jingoistic and patriotic flavor. It certainly hasn't had a flavor of reflection of where we've come 10 years later. And interestingly enough, Paul Krugman wrote a piece on Sunday, a blog piece that's infuriated the right wing in this country, basically saying that what happened after 9/11 was deeply shameful. And he goes after people like Rudy Giuliani and President Bush as fake heroes, and feels an atrocity has been hijacked for political purposes, and not just for political purposes, but for political purposes that have ended up being incredibly counterproductive and devastating for the United States, not to mention the 5,000 lives that the U.S. has lost since the 3,000 that were killed on 9/11, but the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis and Afghanis who've lost their lives too. It is pretty astounding that this moment has gone by without that kind of serious reflection.
Yeah, I suppose it's astounding, but is it surprising? I'm not sure it is. I mean, the very point that Paul Krugman made has ensured that the remembrance of 9/11 has the same qualities the immediate aftermath of the events did. That is, it becomes a kind of sacred, patriotic exercise. I know the feeling ran very high in New York around the time of the anniversary and during the anniversary, but I completely agree with you and with Krugman that some of the reflections one might have wanted to hear about the stranger things that happened during the last decade and the more harmful things, not least a completely unnecessary war that was fought in Iraq that killed, as you said, hundreds of thousands of people, including more than 4,000 Americans, and some of the other severe mistakes that were made that really you have seen almost no debate, discussion, calm remembrance of why these mistakes were made. Instead, it's become a kind of exercise in national patriotic worship. And I think that's an enormous pity, particularly since I think it's fair to say that some of the aftermath of 9/11, particularly the events surrounding the Iraq War, were times in which many of our most resilient national institutions were really undermined in a way that they haven't really recovered from. I'm thinking about not only the government, and not just the Bush administration, but the Congress, which, of course, supported the war, but also the journalistic establishment, the intellectual elite, which largely supported the war. We had in the wake of that war, a couple of years later, very extensive apologies published in the pages of our nation's two most influential newspapers, the New York Times and the Washington Post, both of which confessed to terrible ongoing mistakes in reporting and having essentially failed the country when it came to looking at the causes that were put forward by the administration for going to war. We've had no, so far as I can see, no reflection back on those mistakes. It's just kind of been passed over. And when you look at, in general, and the piece is really about this, some of the egregious decisions that were made, in particular, the decision to torture, we're talking about a kind of moral ambiguity and a moral burden and a moral stain that the country still bears, not only because those decisions were made, not only because we have an extensive record of torture that was used and who decided and how, but we're still in a world in which the former president, George W. Bush, and Vice President Richard Cheney can publish their memoirs and basically proudly say within them, yeah, I decided to torture and I'd do it again. George W. Bush recounts how when his CIA director, George Tenet, asked him whether he should waterboard Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, his proud answer was, damn right. And, of course, Richard Cheney has been on a lot of television interviews leading up to 9/11, talking about how he wouldn't do anything differently and how he would use these techniques again and excoriating the Obama administration for not using them. And finally, and I think most shockingly and most sadly, is the Obama administration, which, on the one hand, the president has said, and so far as we know, there's truth to it, that he's forbidden these techniques. But even in saying this, and saying I've prohibited torture, as he said when accepting the Nobel Peace Prize, that statement itself embodies some of the moral ambiguity and moral torture, as it were, the country finds itself in now. Because, you know, President Obama does not have the power to prohibit torture. Torture is illegal according to domestic statute, according to international treaty. It is absolutely illegal. And when he says I prohibited it, you know, by virtue of his order as president, it really, in a sense, is a refers back to his predecessor who claimed the power to order it. You can't order it. You can't prohibit it. It's illegal. So we now have, I mean, this is what the phrase state of exception means in the title of my New York Review piece, that we've entered this world, this kind of state of emergency that is endless, where we've become, in a sense, a different people. We forget about it. We don't think about it. But in fact, torture, which was once illegal, which was once an anathema, is now, in effect, a policy choice. And that is an enormous change. And there was no, of course, reflection on that or talk about it. There's no national conversation about it. We seem to have accepted it. And it means that the way other countries look at us, including countries in the Middle East, is profoundly changed. I mean, the U.S. still thinks of itself as a leader in human rights, but the rest of the world does not. And Americans seem strangely unaware of this.
Well,
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I just interviewed recently Glenn Carl, the CIA officer who was involved in torture.
Yes.
I mean, he's obviously a decent man who was put in an impossible situation. It felt that, you know, he knew the orders were coming from Cheney. He thought they were wrong morally and practically because they thought he knew they had the wrong guy. And it's just amazing to think that those stories aren't coming to the fore. I guess Ali Soufran's new book that the CIA is censoring may have an impact because he's detailed a litany of missed opportunities and high-level dysfunction between the CIA and the FBI. And as you know, Mark, you know, a lot of this void of information about what really went wrong has been filled by these nonsensical 9/11 truthers. So there's so much work to be done to get the truth out because, you know, not just the damage that's done, but clearly the full story hasn't been told.
Well, I think that's true, and I'm very glad that Ali Soufran's book is coming out. I haven't read it yet. I think it was published today, if I'm not mistaken. But I have followed, first of all, the writing he's done under his own name. And earlier, he, of course, was widely quoted by a lot of journalists without using his name. As the man who was the first interrogator to work interrogating Abu Zubaydah, who was the first major high-level detainee to be tortured in the spring of 2002. So Ali Soufran is a very credible figure with a long record of speaking out candidly about what was actually going on in the intelligence world, and in particular with respect to interrogation and so-called enhanced interrogation techniques. And he's been absolutely relentless in arguing, as an experienced interrogator, that these things don't work, that they're counterproductive. And he, when he argues that, he does it with a great deal of credibility. I don't know that there's anybody in the government who's had more experience than he has in interrogating terrorists. Not to put too fine a point on it, he knows he's got an enormous amount of credibility when he writes that. When he writes that book, so I hope his book gets a lot of attention and a lot of people read it. having said that, I'm not sure, and I say this sadly, that on the one hand, there is more to come out. I'm glad his book is being published, and I hope many more will be as well. But, and again, I say this with sadness, that I think the main story about torture, about many of the mistakes leading up to 9/11 and after it, a lot of those stories are out. And, you know, when it comes to torture in particular, we know a great deal about what happened in those so-called black sites. We know a great deal about what happened in Guantanamo. And I would like to think that the real problem here is that the truth has to come out. Once it does, you know, the attitude of the American people will change. We'll be focusing more on this and so on. But I've been writing about this. You know, I published the first book I did on torture in 2004. That's 7 years ago. And at this point, I don't know. I hate to say it, but I think that it isn't simply a question of the truth not having come out. It's a question of the fact that many Americans, for what other reason we can speculate about, are willing to live with this. I have to say I was surprised about it, that there was outrage following the images from Abu Ghraib. But in many other cases, you know, when it came to waterboarding and other things, in essence, Americans seem willing to live with it. I hate to come to that conclusion, but I think it's hard to avoid.
Just in closing, though, Mark Danner, I'm arguing that the truth has not come out in the sense that nobody has done a full accounting of the mistakes that Bush and Cheney and the administration plus the intelligence community made in allowing this to happen, this 9/11 attack. The monstrous incompetence, and this is some of the stuff that's coming out in Souffron's book about how the missed opportunities to detect this, the attitude of Bush and Cheney towards Clinton, the dismissive way that Condoleezza Rice, et cetera, were towards Richard Clarke and the other Cassandras who were warning this was coming, along with the TEDs, the CIA, the extent to which obviously some kind of an agreement was made between Bush and Tenet that nobody would be held responsible and everything would be fine, and they just turned this opportunity into one for launching wars, putting through his own reactionary domestic agenda for which he wasn't elected, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this is what I feel is missing is, you know, the thing that haunts Cheney and Bush, I think, what really haunts them, and this is why the 9/11 truth is so stupid, is what really haunts these people is that they are responsible and they've never accepted responsibility and that they did screw up. Not just once, but many times.
Yes, I certainly. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's my final rant.
Well, I agree with your final rant, and I think that's true. And I think there's a lot of sort of psycho-political thinking to be done on why exactly they did the things they did. And I agree with you that in essence, some of it had to do simply with guilt and with the realization that they had been warned about this. That some of those warnings were explicit in the form of the presidential daily brief. About, you know, bin Laden determined to attack within the United States and so on, and quite a number of other things as well. I mean, if you look at the Colleen Rowley thing from Minneapolis, if you look at the reports from Arizona about pilots and training, if you look at the failure to follow the two 9/11 terrorist conspirators in San Diego, tracked by the CIA from Malaysia, and then inexplicably never passed on to the FBI. There's a whole story there that I gather Ali Soufan has a number of things to say about. It was implied in Larry Wright's wonderful book, The Looming Tower, that the idea that this, you know, was a question of the government not connecting the dots, it was simple bureaucratic incompetence and so on, is ridiculous, and that it seems much more likely that the Saudis were trying to recruit these guys. There's a lot of evidence for that. And so the CIA essentially held off specifically telling the FBI. And, you know, in retrospect, that was a horrible, horrible mistake because, in effect, they could have prevented probably the plot from coming to fruition. And that is something that we have not talked about. And that, you know, to go back to your rant, Bush and Cheney surely knew. I think I agree that there's a lot of spade work to be done here. In joining those stories together. And I think that the realization of the failure to prevent those attacks had a lot to do with what happened subsequent to them. I mean, you know, the simple reality is that you didn't need a lot of new laws and a lot of new government powers to prevent those attacks. You just needed to do the things that the various agencies, particularly the CIA and the FBI, were supposed to do. And one of the functions in the wake of 9/11 of the Patriot Act, of you know, all of these increased powers for the CIA, the increased surveillance, the warrantless wiretapping, you know, you can go on and on. One of the reasons for all of those things, it seems to me, is insofar as you say we have to take the gloves off, to use the phrase of the era, you're implying that the reason for the attack's success was that the gloves were on in some way. In other words, there weren't sufficient government powers to allow you to prevent the attacks to begin with. Therefore, in the wake of their success, you ask for all these sufficient powers, which themselves are essentially exculpatory. So I think you're completely right. I think a lot of what happened after 9/11 has to do with the failure to do certain things before 9/11. And to the extent that Ali Soufan's book is about that story, I salute him. I hope a lot of people read it. I hope it's a bestseller. And maybe it will begin, maybe after the anniversary now, we're ready to have the kind of debate that you and I are lamenting to take place on the 10th anniversary.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today from Ramallah in the Palestinian territory, Mark Danner. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Ian. It's great to talk to you.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Danner, who is a writer, journalist, and professor. He's a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker, a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books, where he has an article out now, After September 11, Our State of Exception. He also wrote a number of bestsellers, including Torture and Truth, America, Abu Ghraib, and The War on Terror. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about whether there are such things as jobs in the future.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more. A woman done left and took all the reason I was working for. You better not try to stand in my way as I'm walking out the door. Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Douglas Rushkoff, who is an author, teacher, and documentarian whose focus is on the ways people, cultures, and institutions create, share, and influence each other's values. He teaches media studies at NYU and the New School University and serves as technology columnist for The Daily Beast. His new book, Program or Be Programmed, 10 Commands for a Digital Age, is a follow-up to his frontline documentary, Digital Nation. And his last book, Life Incorporated, was also made into a short, award-winning film. Douglas Rushkoff has conceived and facilitated the Contact Summit, scheduled for October the 20th in New York City, that will bring together technologists, artists, activists, business people, funders, and other stakeholders in the hope to revive the spirit of optimism and infinite possibility of the early cyber era to reverse the trend of government-enacted blackouts to policies of Facebook, the monopolies of central banks, and the loss of net neutrality. Welcome to Background Briefing, Douglas Rushkoff.
Hey, it's great to be with you.
And you have an article out, Are Jobs Obsolete?, which asks some, I think, painful but very provocative questions. And particularly following the president's address to the nation, imploring the Congress to act on creating jobs. You begin by saying the U.S. Postal Service is not being put out of business by a right-wing or left-wing politics, but by technology, email.
Right. I mean, it's funny. They CNN called and asked me to do a piece on the post office. You know, I'm supposed to be the guy with the technology beat. And they wanted me to say, what can the post office do to, you know, create jobs and to maintain jobs, especially in light of, you know, Obama's speech and the nation's need for jobs. And as I was sitting thinking about it, I was wondering, well, is jobs really the thing everybody wants? I mean, I know everyone wants money, or more than that, they want shelter and food and schools and things, but is jobs really the thing everybody wants? I mean, why is that suddenly the goal rather than just a means? And, you know, I was looking at the fact that, you know, we got the ability to create technologies now, the kinds of things people dreamed about in the 40s and 50s that really do make certain kinds of work obsolete. And we don't have an economy that knows how to deal with the abundance that these efficiencies create. You know, so American workers can become more efficient. We can literally work ourselves out of our own jobs, whether it's through, you know, having tags that make toll collectors obsolete or email that makes certain kinds of postal carrying obsolete. But we don't have a way of really sharing the spoils. You know, so now we burn food in order to keep market prices high. We've got, you know, Bank of America demolishing houses in California in order to maintain the market value of homes.
While laying off 30,000 people.
While laying off 30,000 people, exactly. So the reason to have a job now is not because we need people to have jobs to actually make the stuff that we need. We need people to have jobs so that we have some rationale through which to distribute the stuff which is already in abundance. And that's, you know, the only way to understand that is ask backwards. It's because we're stuck using really a model of employment, a model of work that was developed, you know, way back in the late Middle Ages and the early Renaissance, really to prevent people from exchanging and creating value in old-fashioned ways. You know, this is really all about the birth of the corporate charter and the birth of chartered monopolies, the birth of centralized currency, and all of these mechanisms that, you know, they did allow colonial powers to grow, but in doing so, they really forced people into a situation where the only way we know how to create value, how to exchange value, is through these giant centralized institutions.
Well, Douglas Rushkoff, when you say we are living in an economy where productivity is no longer the goal, employment is, and that you're asking for a way that we can organize our society around something other than employment, it would seem to me that that question is being, in effect, dodged. And while the president is asking for jobs, and apparently the Republican congressmen are getting screamed at when they go home by their constituents who aren't happy with their performance, but it would seem that because of the way technology has evolved and how, you know, you point out that every new computer program basically is doing some task that a person used to do, we know that household income and productivity have tracked fairly consistently since the 70s. And then in about 2000, they started to diverge, where all the benefits of productivity go to capital and not to labor. That seems to be inevitable, and I don't see the corporate class or the international globalists, billionaires, wanting to change that equation because they're the ones that are doing well. Surely it's incumbent on the rest of us to start using our imagination, because frankly, when the president's asking for jobs and the Congress are going to whittle down his proposal till the point that it's meaningless, that's not going to do it. Don't you think it's really essentially incumbent upon on us all, including in particular the political left, to start thinking in these terms?
Well, right. I originally thought that would have been, you know, Obama's plan. That someone who can think beyond the current paradigm, you know, would be able to see that, oh, the way to fix the economy is not necessarily to figure out how do we get a bank to lend money to a corporation so they can set up a factory in a town that then employs people. You know, that's a real long way around. If you've got a city, you know, a place like Lansing, Michigan, with, you know, huge unemployment, if you have a city where you have people who have skills and other people who have needs, and vice versa, that you really have the makings of an economy. You know, and a economy can work in a peer-to-peer fashion. You don't need to borrow money from Citibank in order to have a business. All you need to have is goods and services and a means through which people can transact. And whether that's going to be bartering, alternative currencies, credit unions. I mean, there's lots of different ways for people to actually get each other the goods and services they need. It's when you start thinking that the only way to get what you need is by getting a job at GM or at Walmart or at Costco, that's going to be the way to get money to then go buy stuff at Walmart and Costco, or to invest through Citibank in the stock of some other big corporation. These are all mechanisms through which value is extracted from people and put in the coffers of corporations or the elites that own them. And I understand that after 300 or 400 years of doing most of our work and our consumption and our investing this way, it's why it's so hard for us to get our heads around the fact that maybe there are other more peer-to-peer ways through which we can do this. And that's really what I think the internet opens up. It really allows us to recreate some of the economic mechanisms that were outlawed as far back as 1200 and 1300.
Well, Douglas Rushkoff, again, author, teacher, and documentarian. He is the author of the new book, Program or Be Programmed, 10 Commands for a Digital Age. When you point out the industrial age was largely about making jobs menial and unskilled as possible, and conversely now in the digital age, we're using technology to increase efficiency, which causes more people to be laid off while corporate profits increase. Now, the bad news is, as you identify, that it looks like that we're heading in a kind of libertarian direction, which is to let those who can't capitalize on the bounty simply suffer, cut social services along with their jobs, and hope they fade into the distance. That seems to be the kind of cruel reality. So your call to arms, if you will, is very welcome, because it seems that we're living in a fool's paradise, thinking that just a few speeches are going to change this vector.
Right. It's unfortunate, but it's so much less expensive to fund sort of basic education of people. You know, it's much easier to for a government to put out on the net, the simple toolkits that municipalities and localities need in order to invigorate their economies from the bottom up. It's much, much more expensive to try to feed banks enough cash so they can somehow stimulate an economy from the top, especially when the enterprises they're creating no longer really have the people involved in those enterprises in mind. You know, where enterprise may have, in some idealistic mode back when, been about creating value for everybody who's involved, workers are not seen as participants in value creation anymore. They're seen as an impediment to value creation. You know, the object of the game is to get, that's when your stock goes up, is when you get rid of a bunch of employees. So the stock price ends up becoming the thing that they want to increase in the short term rather than the creation of value. Even corporations today, the sad truth for them is that, they're basically these big piles of cash. Corporations are actually getting worse at creating money with their money. They're just getting better at collecting money, and there's a very big difference. If they're just sitting on stockpiles of money, that's not healthy for the economy. Then there's no longer money in circulation. So real innovation ends up being discouraged, and efficiencies really become a substitute for any kind of value creation.
So Douglas Rushkoff, just briefly describe for us, and to try and sort of take the scales off our eyes, if you will. I know it's a real challenge, but you're saying that food and shelter are basic human rights, but the value we create is for the rest of us. Is the stuff that makes life fun, meaningful, and purposeful. In other words,
right,
we no longer need to make stuff in order to make money. We need instead to exchange information-based products. Explain that.
Well, it's funny. If in fact, and I believe we do, if in fact we have enough food for everybody on the planet, And if, in fact, we can pretty easily create decent shelter for everyone on the planet, then we start to realize that the reason why people don't have these things is because, you know, we're hoarding things in certain ways, because we're destroying, as we said, you know, we're demolishing homes, we're destroying food, because we have a market system that we need to keep afloat. There's this market, this other thing, this abstracted economic system we need to keep flowing.
That's the food quotas and all that stupid agricultural policy that forces us.
Which starves people,
right.
Which is really what its functions ended up being. I think what we can do is still have an economy, but if we can begin to look at things like, you know, food, air, water, shelter, those are sort of basic human rights. I don't think we have to believe that once people have food, shelter, and water and the very basics of their lives taken care of, that doesn't mean they won't compete anymore. That doesn't mean they won't still want to make great things and do things, because at that point, once your basic needs are taken care of, it's not just, you're not just going to be lazy. Then you're going to want to learn how to surf. Or you're going to want to learn to play video games. Or you're going to want to become a smart person. Or you're going to want to have good massage or good comic books. I mean, people are still going to have a competitive spirit. We don't lose that sort of evolutionary fact doesn't just disappear, but what we can do is place that on a higher sort of a higher value of stuff. We could put that on a secondary level of not just creature comfort, but at that point, greater aspiration. So we can still make things, whether we're, you know, making things in the digital space, which is relatively infinite, making games and educational tools, whether we're doing services for one another, we can still have money, make money. We can still have people who are relatively wealthier and people who are relatively poor. The market doesn't go away. It's just that the base level can go up. You know, and once the base level goes up, then the economy isn't quite as fat anymore. Then all that stuff people just have. We don't have to start ripping down houses anymore. We don't have to just produce things and stuff in order to destroy the planet in order to have economic activity. Now economic activity can move into a much, almost a realm of entertainment and meaning and education and healing and conflict resolution. There's plenty of things that we can be producing that aren't the very basic needs that people need to stay alive. So the efficiencies that we've created don't have to destroy the economy if we can kind of level up our interests and level up the field on which we're competing.
So that doesn't mean, that means then that people don't have to go to work each day, waste all that energy in gridlock on the freeways. But how do they just get some simple, and we only got a couple of minutes here, how do you, for example, get the money to buy the surfboard, let alone the computer?
Well, the way you'd buy, I mean, the same way you would now, in a sense, get the money to buy the food. You know, the people who are eating today are not necessarily the people who have jobs. They're people who work. You know, I don't have a job. You know, every once in a while I get to teach at a school when I can afford it. But, you know, I do adjunct, which is almost like charity these days. You know, the way I create value is by, you know, writing books and articles and advising people and helping people, you know, with their local businesses and, you know, making myself useful. I mean, I think we're moving into an increasingly freelance reality where people realize the way to make money is very often by creating value directly for other human beings in your direct community and in your extended virtual community, rather than trying to get, you know, a good old-fashioned W-2 job at one of the big corporations, you know, and then you don't have to travel to work. So I'm not saying that work is over. I think work continues. It's just work becomes a much more individual thing. And again, it ends up looking something like the more successful decades or centuries of the late Middle Ages, where people actually did things rather than got jobs.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us. Very interesting conversation, Douglas Rushkoff.
Oh, thanks. Well, thanks for what you do.
Again, speaking with Douglas Rushkoff, the author of Program or Program 10 Commands for a Digital Age and Life Incorporated, How Corporations Conquered the World and How We Can Take Them Back. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we began with Mark Danner, who writes for the New York, used to write for the New Yorker, now for the New Yorker Review of Books, written some of the definitive books on torture in the age of Bush and Cheney. He was in Ramallah in the Palestinian territory. We're talking about the very, very soon there'll be a declaration of statehood, which the U.S. is apparently predetermined to veto. In Monday's New York Times, the Saudis, through their former ambassador here to the United States, former head of intelligence, warned the United States not to veto, saying it would destroy relations with Saudi Arabia. And the U.S.'s already thin and tattered credibility in the Middle East would be completely destroyed. He also went on to warn that, in fact, it would be a gift to Syria and to Iran. And I asked Mark Danner what the local reaction was, and he said it's kind of on the West Bank, it's particularly dismal, and he thinks that there may be a revival of the Intifada. And on the Israeli side, of course, there have been massive street demonstrations, young people mostly, demonstrating against the fact that they don't have a future because the country is run by a few oligarchs, which is in many ways a reflection of what the Arab Spring's about. So I also asked him about his article in the New York Review of Books, After September 11th, Our State of Exception, where he basically says, you know, we've got this state of exception where the president said he would we would no longer torture, but the people who made torture, which was already illegal, have never been punished. And there's no, and he's saying there's really an exception here that we have tortured and we've never ever sanctioned ourselves for torture, and in effect, it's still on the books. He also went on to praise Krugman, who's being screamed at by the right wing, for saying this 9/11 celebration, we should have been much more reflective. In fact, we should be shameful about what happened in the intervening 10 years. I said to him, I think we should really have a full debate on what happened in these 10 years, the lives, the hundreds of thousands of people we killed, not to mention the thousands of our own servicemen on these immoral and illegal wars. But also the real accounting should be with Bush and Cheney about how they let this happen. And more evidence is coming out with this new book by Ali Soufran that the CIA and never told the FBI. There were many, many occasions when Bush's people could have stopped 9/11. And that's the real inquiry that should take place. And he agreed that that should be the case. And in many ways, the 9/11 truthers are distracting us from the need for Bush and Cheney to accept responsibility for what they've done, rather than accuse them of absurd things that they were incapable of doing. Then we talked with Douglas Rushkoff, who has an interesting take on the jobs issue, where the president's asking the Congress for more jobs. It's not likely he'll get them. But Douglas Rushkoff's asking whether or not jobs are obsolete in the digital age. And with technology increasing efficiency, that results in more people being laid off while corporate profits increase. A very interesting discussion. He really is calling for an imagination, particularly on the part of the left. The right will go ahead and make money for themselves, and the libertarians will just cut everybody loose and have to fend for themselves. But unless there's a major new imagination going on here, we're all going to be unemployed, whereas we could live very interesting and imaginative lives. I'm Ian Masters. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. This program is available for podcasts, and you can sign up there at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.